This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're hearing some gloomy predictions about the future of Russia. The economic reformers resigned from Yeltsin's cabinet, and now many Americans who were looking forward to a new free market economy are worrying about economic chaos. After the December parliamentary elections, many experts warned the old guard is regaining power. Plus, extremist Vladimir Zhirinovsky's party got nearly 25% of the vote. To get a handle on the situation, we invited back William Taubman. He's the author of several books about the Soviet Union and a professor of political science at Amherst College. He's now writing a biography of Khrushchev. Taubman made his first trip to Russia about 30 years ago. His latest trip was in January. He was there during President Clinton's visit and when the economic reformers resigned.
I must say, when I got back from my recent trip to Russia and read the American press coverage of the period when I had been there, I was struck by how oversimplified it tends to be. We get the picture depicted in black and white tones. We're told there are good and bad guys. We're told there's a clash between the old and the new. We're informed that there are reformers fighting with reactionaries. But when you're over there, talking to people and living in Moscow, everything is gray. Not only the weather, but in the sense that everything is much more complex. The good guys make mistakes. The bad guys are telling at least part of the truth. The new forces are acting in old ways. The reformers have had some successes, but they've also made a mess of things. But the anti-reformers, or the critics of the reformers, if they got their way, I think would make an even greater mess of things, in part because the reformers and what we call the reactionaries undermine each other, cancel each other out, prevent one or the other from acting in the kind of consistent way which might produce success.
Can you basically sum up for us what the big economic debate is between the reformers and the other people in the government?
I think so, although I'm not an economist myself, so you have to make an allowance for that. But as I understand it, what the reformers wanted to do, let's put it this way, they wanted to do four things. They wanted to stabilize the currency, they wanted to liberalize prices, they wanted to privatize firms, and they wanted to create a safety net for the people who would become unemployed in the process. And they succeeded, I think, in doing the second and third of these things. They did liberalize prices, they did privatize a great number of firms, but they failed to stabilize the currency, and they haven't created that safety net. And in the absence of that safety net, people are justifiably frightened, which raises the question of why they haven't succeeded in the things that they've failed to do. Now, they blame their critics, and they also blame the West for not coming through with big, very big bucks that they need to create the safety net and to stabilize the currency. But my criticism of the reformers is that they're living in an unreal world if they think that there was going to be no criticism, and if they think that the West was just going to come forward and hand them $24 billion, even though, quite true, we promised we would. In other words, they've been undermined by the realities of the world in which they live, both at home and abroad. But my feeling is that the alternative to reform, which I'll try to explain, is also has an Achilles heel. Now, what is the alternative? What the anti-reformers want to do is to keep the old, or at least the commanding heights, as the Soviets used to call them, of the old economy in action. Keep the old firms going, subsidize them because they produce goods and because they produce jobs.
And these are all the old state-run industries,
right,
and state-run farms.
Right. And so the question immediately arises: if you do that, then won't you have an incredible hyperinflation? And the answer of the critics, as I understand it, if they're really being honest about it, is yes, we will, but we'll stop it with wage and price controls. But the problem with this is also an aspect of Russian reality. The problem is that the government doesn't govern. And the state, although it's bloated in terms of numbers of bureaucrats, hardly exists when it comes to having authority in the minds of people. So who is going to control prices? Who's going to control wages across the length and breadth of this vast country? I don't think they could pull that off, even if they tried.
In the talk about inflation, when we look ahead and we worry about inflation in Russia, are we talking about something that's problematic or catastrophic?
Well, at the moment, inflation, it's been around 30% a month. It's gone down, I think, to about 15% a month. The technical definition of inflation is 50% a month. And what the reformers are saying now is that the subsidies to these old firms, as Chernomyrdin wants to hand them out, will produce inflation over 50% a month, which is hyperinflation. That really heads you toward Weimar Germany levels, toward Latin American levels at the worst of Latin American inflation. That is catastrophic. At the moment, it's devastating, but not yet catastrophic.
What do you make of Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the nationalist and, I guess, racist, who seems pretty scary from here, from reading the press? His party received about 24% of the party preference vote, and he's advocated restoration of the Soviet Empire, using military force to achieve national goals. How popular is he? How much power do you think he really has? Is he symptomatic of something?
I think he, well, seen from close up, as I saw him in Moscow, I didn't see him personally, but on television, and I talked to a lot of people, asked everybody about him. Mm-hmm. Seen from close up, he is both scarier than he is from here and more fragile, I think. When I was there, on one of the Sunday evenings when I was there, they broadcast a hour-long TV survey of the news of the week, the past week, and they devoted 5 or 10 minutes at the end to news clips of Zhirinovsky in action that week. And in one of them, he was screaming at the top of his lungs at the parliament. In another one, he was about to have a fight with a fellow deputy in a cafeteria line. In another one, he was fulminating against America as the evil empire and saying that after Russia saved the West from Napoleon and Hitler, the West should feed them for free. He appears to be at the edge of reality, but he also seems crazy like a fox. His very irrationality has the effect, I think, to some extent, of influence of insulating him from responsibility. That is, whatever the current government does and whatever the current parliament does, people may very well say, well, Zhirinovsky is not responsible because he's not a responsible person. And this may help him preserve some, oddly enough, some credibility later on.
But you said you thought he was maybe more fragile than
well,
he appears to
he's
be.
He's fragile because he seems virtually out of control.
Mm-hmm.
He looks as if any moment he will sort of sail off into space, lose control entirely. He looks as if his emotions have got the better of him. He looks as if he's psychologically capable of self-destructing before the 2 years pass, which will lead us to the next presidential election. He also looks as if he's capable of so alienating people, not only in other parties, but in his own, that he might be the victim of some kind of plot or some kind of purge.
So meanwhile, what's the military and the former secret police like now?
Well, actually, the military is holding back. It was reluctant to act in December when Yeltsin ended up ordering it to bombard the parliament. It eventually did bring itself to do so, I think with great unwillingness and distaste. It would like the politicians to do the politicking. It would like the government to govern. It would like to stay out. But as I think about the future, it seems to me the military is going to be sorely tempted to intervene far more drastically than it has so far. And my reasoning is that if I'm right, that both reform and the counter-reform program are bound to run into trouble, that means that the situation is going to get worse before it gets better. And if it gets worse and Zhirinovsky doesn't self-destruct, then he's going to be in a position to pick up the pieces. And even if he does self-destruct, it's all too likely that somebody else will appear who will then appeal to his constituency. If that is the case, then 2 years from now, they are likely to face a presidential election in which, even if Yeltsin runs, he will have been further discredited, and his health isn't that good to begin with either. Zhirinovsky will be, or somebody who replaces him, will be a very viable candidate, and the military will have to decide whether they like him enough to let him into office or whether they're frightened of him enough to take power themselves.
Hmm.
And I think it's all too likely, if you spin this scenario out, that they will take power.
The military?
Yes.
And so in what, like a military dictatorship would be?
In some kind of a military dictatorship. I think I even see over the horizon somebody who might fill the role of dictator. There is a 44-year-old general, a kind of charismatic, very outspoken type, who seems to be almost a rogue general. He is the commander of the 14th Russian Army, which is based in the Transdniester region in Moldova. And every other day he says something that really should bring him a court-martial if there were a functioning civilian control over the military. It's all too easy to imagine him or somebody like that thrusting the top defense minister Grachev and his senior colleagues out of the way and taking over. But I'll say one more thing, which probably will get me into trouble with my Russian friends and even with my own conscience. And I could see a case for the military's taking over. That is, if it gets to the point where the choice is between chaotic politics as usual and somebody like Zhirinovsky, I think the military would be the lesser evil. It might even be able to provide the stability which and the consistency which would allow either the reform program or some alternative to it to go forward consistently enough to produce more success than they've had so far.
William Taubman is my guest, professor of political science at Amherst College and author of a forthcoming biography of Khrushchev. We're going to take a short break and be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with William Taubman, professor of political science at Amherst College. He traveled most recently to Russia January 8th through January 22nd. There have been rumors that Boris Yeltsin is sick and very depressed. Were you able to find out anything about that while you were in Russia?
I certainly don't have any confirmation on the basis of any personal experience. I did attend the reception for President Clinton at the American Embassy, and I'd hoped to see Yeltsin there, but he was waiting for Clinton at his dacha. But the rumors are so omnipresent as to suggest that there must be some fire where there's all this smoke. And Yeltsin has this very unnerving pattern, which could be indeed explained either by illness or by alcohol or by some other syndrome, which we don't fully understand. He has this penchant for lapsing into inactivity after a crisis, just when by rights he ought to move decisively to take advantage of his new strength. He's done this several times, and in some ways he seems to be doing it again.
The Clinton administration's policy has been to tie financial aid to Russia to Russian progress toward economic reform. Now that the reformers have left the cabinet, what might change in the Clinton administration policy? What kind of decisions does our government have to make about Russia now?
Well, I must say I have my reservations about the policy.
About tying financial aid to economic reform?
Yes, it seems to me that it should not be up to us to tell them what to do and to attach conditions to our aid such that they're forced to do what we tell them. It's up to us. If we don't think they're proceeding in the right fashion, I think we're free not to to help them. But I think the worst situation is when we tell them what to do, they do it, we then don't provide the money that we've promised, things go badly, and we get blamed. I think what we need now is what might be called a little damage limitation. That is, rather than trying to make things perfect, we ought to try not to make them worse. And we ought to try to make sure that we don't become the target when things get bad.
Are we the target now?
We are increasingly the target, I'm afraid. One finds anti-Americanism growing. It's visible in all sorts of ways. I had a conversation with a kind of centrist politician while I was there, and he said that he saw his task as providing the Russians with a kind of centrist alternative to Zhirinovsky. And the whole spirit that he seems to have in mind came out in the conversation. He was full of criticism for the United States. He was full of bitterness about the advice we've given and the money that we haven't given. And if he was representative, and I think he is, the message that a lot of centrist politicians and even some liberal politicians have gotten from the Zhirinovsky phenomenon is it is politically prudent to bash the United States.
So we're perceived as having made a commitment to give money if they head toward economic reform. They tried to head toward economic reform, and we didn't follow through and give them the money.
Well, that's the least, actually, of the charge against us. On the paranoid fringe, which is where somebody like Zhirinovsky quite properly belongs, they have a kind of conspiracy theory, which is that we deliberately foisted on them a reform program, knowing that it would destroy their economy, and we're waiting to pick up the pieces. And the primary pieces that we're waiting to pick up are their very valuable raw materials, their uranium, their oil, their gas, their property, taking advantage of the fact that foreigners can now invest in Russia. In other words, this conspiracy theory turns our efforts, our constructive efforts to help them out by offering them aid and by promoting investment into a devious plot to do them in.
You were in Russia when President Clinton visited there in January. What did his trip look like from the vantage point of the Russian people and the Russian press?
Actually, having criticized just now some of the policy of the administration, I should say that Clinton himself was sensationally good.
Mm-hmm.
He came across just the way I think he wanted to, as somebody who was there to sympathize and to support, but not to dictate, and not even to give too much advice. I heard him speak at the American Embassy, and then I watched him on television during his town hall performance. And I watched this with some Russian friends who were absolutely enchanted by the natural, the easy, natural style of the president. They said to me that their politicians talk about being Democrats, but here was a man who was a Democrat in his bones. The kind of easy familiarity with the questioner, combined with a kind of authority which sits gracefully on his shoulders. The moment when he called the 9-year-old Russian boy out of the audience, who had recalled Clinton's handshake with Kennedy at an early stage, and shook hands with this boy and said, "Now, maybe when you become Russian president, you can remember this handshake." People were really quite enchanted with him. But even there, it's interesting there the way in which the language gets in the way. I was listening on Russian television, so I could both hear him speaking in the background and I could hear the translation. Mm-hmm. And several times he said in English, talking about what the Russians have to do, he said, "Well, you'll have to do this, you'll have to do that." And the Russian translation was a phrase of "вы должны," which means "you must." And it carries with it the connotation, "I'm telling you, do this, you must do it now." So even the language or the translation problem conspires to turn his effort to offer this general sort of encouragement into what the Russians sometimes heard as advice of the wrong sort.
You've been traveling to Russia for many years. Where do you stay now, and how does that compare to where you used to stay?
Well, if you go back far enough, I took my first trip there in the summer of 1964. All through the Soviet period, you had to stay in hotels. You weren't even allowed to stay with friends. You had to tell the Russian visa authorities before you got your visa how long you were going to spend in each place and where you were going to stay. And when you got there, you gave your passport to the hotel administrator, as it's called, the front desk, and they would register your presence with the police. Nowadays, anything goes. You still need a visa, and your visa is still for a particular period of time, but you're not asked where you're going to stay. And I and most of my American colleagues and friends now try to stay with Russian friends. We stay in apartments, and Russians are very glad to have you, both because of the friendship, but also because while you're there, you can spend some of your dollars to get food for yourself and for
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
And I also try, I say to myself, if I were staying in a hotel, I'd be paying some outlandish sum. The fancy Western hotels charge New York rates now. The Metropole Hotel, when I was there a year ago September was already charging $250 a night for a room. They must be up toward $500 by now.
Well,
so if you contribute some small fraction of what you would pay to a hotel to your own upkeep in your friend's apartment, that is likely to amount to several months, the equivalent of several months' salary for your friends. So it's in everybody's interest. Not to mention the fact that you'll do better eating food that's prepared in somebody's kitchen than in than a hotel kitchen.
Right. Do you have a sense of popular opinion in Russia now about whether there's a lot of optimism that change for the better is possible, or a lot of cynicism that nothing good is really going to happen in the near future?
Actually, if you look at the public opinion polls that have been taken in recent weeks, they show a slight smidgen of optimism. That is, compared to polls taken several months ago or a year ago, more people say that they have hope for the future. More people think that the worst can be avoided. And until you look at the political scene and look at the parties who represent these people in parliament, you almost begin to be hopeful. But the figures are still, it is still just a smidgen. The people who are desperate or hopeless or cynical still, I think, far outnumber those who are beginning to show optimism. The change is only relative. So in that sense, this is a people who are pretty glum, who see their own situation as pretty bleak. And I think one of the most destructive aspects of the situation is that, in a sense, even though they don't say it, they blame themselves. They have a very low self-image as a country, as a people. They've lost their empire. They've lost the Soviet Union. Their economy is in a shambles. And this low self-image, I think, contributes to their willingness to support politicians who lash out at other politicians.
Bill Talman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
William Talman is a professor of political science at Amherst College. He's currently writing a biography of Khrushchev. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.